When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code AUDIO to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code AUDIO at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code AUDIO.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 819. I would now like to share some Nerdist Community Corkboard happenings on from people like you in the Nerdist community. You can send your event to events@nerdist.com, and Katie or Kyle will pull it up and present it to you, the Nerdist audience, for your approval. This is from the Corkboard. Nerdist recently had another Inkshares book contest, and the winners are almost available to buy. The first book will be out, or actually was out, August 2nd. It's called It's All Fun and Games by Dave Barrett. It's a story about six high school friends who spend their weekends with their LARP group, but they soon realize that the fantasy world they imagine has transformed into something real. The second book will be available August 9th, which is my mom's birthday. You didn't need to know that, but wish her a happy birthday on the 9th at Nerdist Mom. That is Welcome to Deadland by Zachary Taylor Linville. It's kind of a coming-of-age tale set against the backdrop of the desolate land that was once Florida, but now devastated by a widespread disease threatening mass extinction. Ugh. A little too real. Anyway, they will be available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and your favorite independent bookstores. Also, Chris Gomez writes, I work for a post-production sound company called Smart Post Sound. We help create the soundtracks for small shows you might have heard of, like Better Call Saul, Modern Family, Supergirl, The Last Ship, DC's Legends of Tomorrow. Recently, we decided to create a podcast called Smart Post Sound Smartcast. Gives listeners a unique behind-the-scenes look at the world of audio post-production. For anyone who's ever had any interest in sound or for film or television, this is the podcast for you. Each week, we have in-depth conversations with industry professionals on everything, where they get started, how they got their foot in the door, to some of their sound mixing and editing techniques, tricks of the trade, and so forth. You can find the podcast by searching Smartcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, TuneIn Radio. Thank you, Chris Gomez. Thank you, Nerdist Community Corkboard. Thank you, Katie and Kyle. This episode is Mr. Mike Birbiglia. A man who I have a tremendous amount of respect for, a comic I adore, writer, director, producer. He's a machine. His work ethic is unparalleled. And he's also super fucking funny. He is promoting his movie, Don't Think Twice. It is in theaters now in L.A. and New York. Soon it'll be expanding to the rest of the country. But please support it. Please support it. You know, guys like Birbiglia go out, they make their own thing. You know, so many times people complain about, oh, the movies are too commercial and they're too this and there's too many reboots and they're too that. Hey, fine. If you feel that way, then you need to go out and fucking support people like Mike Birbiglia who are going out there and making shit on their own. Or you need to go out there and make shit on your own. So go to a theater, support the art of film and comedy. And go watch Don't Think Twice. It's kind of about, well, he describes it in the show. It's kind of about an improv group that some of them start to become successful, some of them don't, and it's just about the dynamic of the group. Really funny, and Mike is a ridiculously talented individual. And now, here's the Nerdist Podcast number 819 with Mr. Mike Birbiglia for Pete!
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast. Our guest today.
The Nerdist Podcast.
Just tuning in.
Nerdist Podcast.
Nerdist Podcast.
You're just tuning in.
Mike Birbiglia. Mr. Birbiglia.
What number is this? Five? Four?
This is probably four. Three or four.
I remember when we did the three-peat.
The three-peat, they came pretty close together. There's been a
this is the four-peat or the five-peat.
We went to your hotel room once,
yeah, I
remember.
We've seen it all.
And the hotel room was actually where I... And I said this when my last special came out. I credited you as sort of being the reason that I did the last special the way I did.
Fun, comfortable.
Yes, because of what you said, which is where you say, you know, I go to a place where I'm uncomfortable and that's where I write from. And I thought, you know, I feel like I don't really do that. I just kind of write about other things and maybe I want to explore what makes me uncomfortable. And so that's how that whole special came about.
Wow.
So thanks.
I love that special.
Oh, thank you.
That special is awesome.
I appreciate that you say that. I appreciate that. That was you've always been very inspirational besides just being a funny human being, but also just the work ethic and the way to approach comedy. And, you know, I mean, there's a real, I think you kind of, when you're young, you have this idealized version of like, well, funny people are just funny. It's like, yeah, they are.
Yeah.
But there is also a craft to it that you need to work on.
Which is a thing that you bring up towards the end of Don't Think Twice.
Yeah.
Which is just like someone's, like people start talking about the work ethic. Like it's, oh, you don't have that work ethic because you've never had it. And then you don't have it. Like stuff like that.
Yeah. And you know what's a good example? This past weekend, I did 28, Ira Glass and I, my producer of Don't Think Twice, and I did 28 Q&As in New York City at the Sunshine Theater.
Oh my God.
And, well, because we really believe in the movie. It's a small movie. And it's like, well, we're going to stand behind it. We're going to do 28 Q&As. And Judd Apatow in solidarity showed up, just a friend of the film, and did four of them with us.
Oh my God!
Saturday afternoon, just popped in, did four of them. Was a moderator.
There's a stage. He's gonna find it.
But it was. But one of the things he told a great story. He goes, I didn't realize it until now. You know, because the film, if you're just tuning in,
at the very beginning,
they have a randomizer on their podcast.
It's about a group of best friends in an improv group, and one of them sort of gets a chance to try out for an SNL type of show, and the rest of them don't. And it's about sort of what happens in friendships when that happens. And Judd told the story. Hopefully it's okay that I'm telling this. He said, this movie was my life. I lived with Sandler, and we were best friends in L.A., and then he said, hey, I'm going to Chicago. I'm going to audition for SNL. That's the worst Sandler impression ever. I went to Kermit.
Well, you know, the truth of the matter is sounded like, hey, I'm going to go audition for SNL. But when you think Sandler, you go, I'm going to go audition.
I'm going to go to Chicago.
Audition. In my crazy sweatshirt.
I'm going to be on Saturday Night Live. The worst. The three tenors.
The three Sandlers.
It's Groundhog Day.
We got to get an infomercial for that.
Yeah, we really do. A nymphomercial.
Ladies and gentlemen, the three Sandlers.
I really need an infomercial.
A nymphomercial.
Hey, do you want to fuck a lot?
Is it an infomercial for nymphos or just a normal infomercial with people that are clearly nymphomaniacs?
Oh, I don't know. I like that. That's more subtle rather than it being like, are you telling me that I can fuck all day long? You know, as opposed to like.
No, it's a pan. What's wrong with you?
Oh.
Such a deep misunderstanding.
You don't have to scrub it.
I'm sorry, it's an issue I have.
So Sandler got the call when Judd was living with him, and Judd said, I felt sorry for him because I was like, he doesn't do impersonations. He doesn't do characters. He's not going to, there's no way he'll get it. And he comes back and he's like, I got the show. And then the three Sandlers.
Yeah,
I'm one of the three Sandlers.
I got the show.
and Judd said, then he stopped performing.
Just stopped doing stand up. Yeah.
Yeah. Because he was like, oh, I'm never going to be as charming and good as that on stage. And so I guess I shouldn't do this. And then, you know, Judd's done a few things since then, but not a lot.
Yeah,
but but the thing with stand up,
come on, you guys, let's hold some feet to the fire here. He hasn't done that many
things. And what is
did he do? Freaks and Geeks or whatever?
Who has a harder time walking down the street? That's what I want to know.
Exactly.
Jed
Yeah, exactly. Nobody even knows the full name.
He did the movie Fat Kids at Camp.
Well, you know I'm always fascinated to see. Who, when people start off in stand-up, who really kind of has the unquenchable fire of a stand-up? Because I think some people maybe consciously use it as a means to an end. I think some people unconsciously use it as a means to an end. Because
the life of a stand-up is an uncomfortable one in terms of it's, you know, it's a lot of travel. You can only get better at it if you do a shit ton of shows.
You have to suck for a long time.
You have to suck, but even after you get famous, then I think people start getting like, oh, if I'm not good, people are going to judge me, or it's going to be weird. Like about how Chris Rock never announces that he's going to perform around New York because he doesn't want people to come and – I mean, when he's working out material.
Yeah.
Not when he actually does a big show. So what do you – where do you land on all that? Because I can't imagine a time where I don't want to do stand-up.
I love stand-up. I'm craving it right now. I'm craving being on stage and working on new material. And but, yeah, I mean, it's – I don't have the status that Chris Rock and Chappelle and Louis and those and Schumer have in New York, where I can just pop into stuff. So
I
have
I bet
to,
you could pop
I
in.
I have to like put in avails and stuff. Yeah. It's very complicated. So yeah, I sometimes do a private, not a private show. I do a private show for 10 friends.
They're honest with me though. They're honest with me. I pay for a lot of stuff, but they're honest with me.
I do like unpublicized shows at Union Hall in Brooklyn.
I perform at Birbiglia's.
in Birbiglia's living room. But Union Hall, because it's down the street from where I live, and it's an awesome comedy venue. One of the great American comedy venues that seats 90 people. You guys, of course, have that.
It's one of my favorite venues. Yeah.
Well, you know, there's kind of a renaissance in L.A. comedy right now where the Comedy Store is amazing now.
Oh, really?
And improv is fantastic now. And so everything's kind of, you know, and Meltdown's really fun, and UCB's got two theaters, and so it's... It's a
I'm
really,
so jealous of Meltdown.
It's a good.
It's a nice little spot.
You know what it is, but it's also tonight. It's very Meltdown's very spoiling, in the sense that it's so great that you might go other places and be like, oh, this joke really killed. I mean, it's really good. I think it's a great place to try brand new stuff.
Well, that's how I feel about anything in Brooklyn. Chris Gathard and I both do. Who's in the movie, both do a lot of stuff in Brooklyn and a lot of stuff in Manhattan. We go to Brooklyn, which I think is your Meltdown, to tell jokes to our friends.
Basically.
And then we take it to Manhattan for what people think.
Yes, what the swath.
People who already don't have the luxury of liking you ahead of time.
Exactly.
I'd say that's the worst part about Meltdowns. Every week I have this safe space I can go and just goof off, and everyone knows me, and I get laughs, and I forget that if I go anywhere else... It's not the same.
And that silence is so punishing.
Yeah, it's weird
in other
because
places.
It's like well, it's me. It's Jonah. Wait, me.
Is it possible that I could play you the laughs that this got somewhere else on my phone?
You're a Pakistani man that can stand next to me.
But that's really the that's really sort of the allure is comedy. A lot of comedy is about very much what you said about discomfort. And when you get too comfortable in a space, I think it's good to balance. I think it's good to do all kinds
of things. Oh, of course,
But, you know, obviously the longer you do comedy, it's like, oh, this feels really good. These people already know me. I don't have to do as much work. It's so easy to get lazy because, you know, or not lazy. I think it just depends on what you want. But
no, I think lazy is right. I think I see specials from certain people who have huge fan bases, and I'm come on, guys.
Come on, you gotta dig.
Come on, don't throw me under the bus. The Gotcha Comedy Podcast. I didn't see it coming, even though it's called the Gotcha Comedy Podcast.
I thought we were just hanging out like friends.
And then I admitted who were overrated comedians.
I'm so sorry. They're just too good. It was just too tempting.
Let's just say I'm
hesitant to use the word lazy in the sense that Joan and I have had this conversation, and I said, you know, if you don't really feel like you have to tour and do, you know, like you don't need to do those other rooms. You could just do the rooms where you feel happy and comfortable. You know, but for me. I just feel like I need to feel like I can survive in other spaces.
Yeah, I like to do shows, like, weirdly. You know, as a stand-up comedian, you reach a point where it's like you're doing, you know, small rooms in Brooklyn, you're doing clubs, and you're doing, you know, maybe a club in Cincinnati, and you're doing corporates, and you're doing colleges, and all those things are very different from each other. And I even like to think, like, when I do like a corporate event, like that's private for like some insurance company or something, like where you literally can't win.
Yeah.
Like they don't never heard of you.
Well, you can't even feel bad about that though.
But it's, I like doing those in some ways to like feel the pain of like, okay, so there's like 3 minutes of that 40 that can work anywhere.
Yeah. But you know what's interesting, though, is that I don't think there's anyone who can really work anywhere. And I think that's – I like to call it pre-Vatican II comedy. That's that comedy from the 80s, like before the reform happened with the where the audiences got savvy. I think there was an 80s style comic who sort of felt like
– Wait, what – but okay, in this, where's the Vatican II? Is it the podcast era?
No, I think it was after the comedy bubble burst.
So after the comedy –
92.
Like, oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, I think after 92, then it, everything became a lot different. And I think that old school, like, you should be able to go into any room, no matter what, in a moment's notice, kill.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think that's a nice ideal, but I do think in general...
It's like a Boston comedy approach.
I think yes. So, because yeah, I do think in general, not every joke works everywhere, you know? Like, it's... there.
But there is a there's a humanity that you're trying to go towards that you want to work everywhere. Like I tell a story on one of my first albums, Sleepwalk With Me, about having a bladder tumor when I was 19, and I couldn't crack that forever. I couldn't make it funny, but it's like the fun comfortable concept. Yeah. Like, once you can make that funny, that... Can I curse? That shit works everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, you can, but thank you so much for asking.
Okay, great.
You can. This is the Gotcha Podcast.
Potty mouth, Mike Birbiglia.
Oh, man.
Shitting on comics, to use his terminology.
I mean, I knew it was called the Gotcha Comedy Podcast, but I didn't make the connection.
No, yeah, no.
They made me swear, which I'm normally not comfortable doing. I mean, I just lost it in there. It just all fell apart.
But that's why, and, you know, that goes to the thing with my movie, Don't Think Twice, is we wanted, when we were testing it with audiences, we wanted it to work with older folks and younger folks. Like, the coolest thing was this weekend with the Q&As, this guy stood up and asked a question. He goes, I'm the oldest person in this room, and I wanted to hate it, but I loved it.
Are you sure it wasn't an Oh Hello character?
Well, I'm familiar with that show, but I don't believe it was. And that was the biggest compliment. I said, what's your question? But he didn't have one. But
my question is, who am I, and how do I and no, can you call a hospital?
It's so close to that. That's what he sounded like. But that was very affirming, is this idea of like that it's for old people and young people, and it's for all, you know, that's the goal. You want it to hit. You want everybody to laugh at the human element of it.
But do you feel like if you have something that speaks to literally everyone, then it kind of doesn't say anything? Like, is it possible to speak to everyone and still have substance?
But I think that I think that's what, if you want to get real wonky with it, I think that's what's kind of life affirming for comedy nerds about Louis, is that you go, everyone likes him. That's pretty good.
I don't know if everyone.
He's really popular and he's really good.
Yeah, he is.
That's rare. You know?
No, I know, but yeah. I think that's what's exciting about his rise in popularity in the 2000s is like you just go, oh, okay, it can work.
I mean, I think
where you're good and you're popular.
I think he bridges he definitely bridges the gap. Like, he can do alternative rooms, he can do mainstream rooms, but I bet there are rooms that people will be like, why is this guy so, you know, why is he talking shit about his kid? I mean, I feel like there are people somewhere that would be like, well, that is offensive, you know?
Yeah.
But I agree. In terms of broadest, like someone who can reach everyone, Louis, Gaffigan, you know?
Yeah.
I think Bill Burr probably, you know, I've seen him win over
rooms.
Well,
Kathleen Madigan's like that. Put her in any room in America.
Yeah.
Crushes.
Yeah. And I don't know if I don't know if I feel like it's necessary for me to be that. Do you feel
that
it's necessary for you to be that?
Clearly, my career dictates otherwise. No, I don't think it is. I don't think I strive for that kind of widespread appeal or success.
You know, I think about, you know, some of my favorite bands are bands that no one will really. And I don't say that to say, like, I like obscure bands. I mean,
easy high fidelity.
Yeah, exactly. But some of my favorite bands are bands that no one will ever hear about. And that's fine. It doesn't take anything away from how much I like them.
Right.
And it's like, you know, if you're going to start bringing in, you know, is it successful art if not everyone knows about it. If only a few people know about it, but they really like it.
I think that's an ego pursuit. I think when people don't like something that everyone likes anymore, it's more about them than it is the art.
Yeah.
Because it's more about them going, I have a need. I need to be addicted to liking obscure hidden things. And once they're not hidden, it holds no intrigue for me. Then you don't really like that thing. You just like the concept of liking things that no one else knows
about.
But
that's from the fan's point of view. I'm talking about from the artist's point of view. Like, is it bad that, you know, there's, you know, for example, like a band I really like called The Weaker Thans. You know, a lot of people know them to where they had a career where they made a good living off of music. But you say that word and no one really knows what you're talking about. It does that take anything away?
And even the Pixies weren't all that popular in their time, and now are like one of the great all time.
Yeah, exactly.
And roll
it's
bands.
Like the idea of like Nirvana. They're more successful commercially than the Pixies, but you know, creatively, is there any difference?
Well, I don't know. I think it's a very complex question with a very complex answer, because I think it depends on why the artist does it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do they do it because they love performing? Do they do it because they want to hear 30,000 people screaming? Do they do it because they just need to be up on stage? Or is it a... I mean, there's so many different reasons why people do things.
Well, I mean, with this movie, I've been traveling around doing these like free improv workshops in like 30 different cities. We've been like with our coach from the movie, Liz Allen. She taught our faux improv group to do improv as a group and created Group Mind. And they came to town early, and it was this cool thing. And now we're doing these free improv workshops. And then she teaches improv, and then I talk to improvisers about sort of how improv principles relate to directing or acting or any kind of creation. And I always just say, I think there's a complete misunderstanding of what success is in America. I think success somehow has become equated with visibility and exposure, and has moved away from actually what success should be, which is connecting with people and helping them in some way and contributing. And I think that as performers, three of us are performers, and we're on our worst days, we probably think of what we do as like a narcissistic pursuit, and we're like, oh, I don't contribute anything. It's actually not true. As a performer, you have the ability at our best, if it's for 20 people at, you know, in a small room, or if it's for thousands of people or millions of people, you have the ability to take someone's day that was really upsetting and in the world situation right now, disturbing, and make them laugh on days than they didn't think they were going to laugh.
Well, I also, and I think, you know, having performed for 20,000 people at Oddball,
oh wow,
or, you know, 30 people at Meltdown, they're totally different experiences, but I love performing for like 30 people in a small room.
Me too.
Because it's so intimate, and comedy really should be intimate.
Yeah.
And being able to connect with individual people and really feeling like, oh, I'm not just talking at you. We're all a part of this thing right now in this one group, and it's really – and that makes it really, really special.
It's funny. The that dumb cover band thing I do with Mark Hoppus from Blink-182, like we were playing at a bar downtown and just like, you know, five cover songs, like a Pixie song, a Descendant song, and just, you know, some stuff like that. And then I asked him, I was like, why – you play stadiums. Mm-hmm. You play arenas. Like, why do you want to take time out of your day to just do this – cover band with a couple other comics? And he's like, oh, it's still performing, it's still fun, and like this way I can actually see the faces of the people I'm playing to.
It's just a different dynamic. And our manager Alex Murray said something once that really I liked a lot, which is, you know, he said, you know, it's okay to be you can be a quiet success. Like, I don't think I'll ever play Madison Square Garden. I don't think I'll ever be able to fill Madison Square Garden, and I don't care. Like,
you mean the worst comedy venue on earth?
Yeah.
that we all pretend is the brass ring of comedy?
Exactly. Oh, you have a laugh? Well, you might as well throw it in the gutter, because I'm not going to hear it there.
It's the biggest lie that we've told ourselves, that that's the brass ring of comedy. I don't know how that rumor got started.
Yeah.
I don't know, because I think it's just, it's kind of what you said.
I'm not going to say who I went to see their comic, but I did not stay.
Say it.
Nope.
Gotcha. See who that shitty comic
Wait
was.
Wait a minute. What are you guys doing to me?
Nothing. We're just asking questions.
You're trying to get me to say a comic that I don't think is that good?
No. On to a different topic. Last five people you saw at Madison Square Garden. Let's see, I saw
speed rounds.
Springsteen.
It's not a good venue. The point is, it's not a good venue. I did my last show, thank God for jokes, off Broadway for 4 months in a 250-seater, the Lynn Redgrave Theater, and I've never felt more connected to audiences in my entire career. 250 seats. I think that's a perfect room.
Well, I think it's very telling that, you know, when Chappelle will do these residencies in San Francisco, he does the Punchline.
I know. Pops. I opened for him in one of those, and I love those crowds.
I did too. It was amazing, yeah. You know, because it's the energy of 200 people in a packed room,
yeah.
I think, is better than 500 people spread out in a large room with high ceilings. And
Todd Glass always says that. Ideal number for a comedy room is like 150 to 200 people.
It's so easy to make a show. It's so easy. You put candles on the tables. Oh, you put up a curtain. You just make the audience feel intimate. You know what? You want to fucking fail. Fuck you. You want to fucking fail.
I'd say one of the key things is low ceiling. Like a low ceiling
is key.
Because it traps in, laughs, bounce
like,
up and down.
You mean like Madison Square Garden? Or
like Madison Square Garden.
Real
low ceiling room. There's a basement I've played there once.
I think
sometimes the basketball players hit their head on the ceiling.
But it's just the games are more fun and exciting.
It's a bringer basketball game. You have to bring, if you bring 100 people, you get to play.
Yeah.
But LeBron is like, I got to play basketball in that comedy room.
The one in the basement of the grocery store?
Yeah, that one. The sight lines are terrible.
But I think there's also something subconsciously subversive about, like, a comedy room should feel a little dirty, I think, in the sense that, you know, maybe we shouldn't be here, maybe we shouldn't be talking about this. That's why some of the rooms that make no sense paper are really great. You know, Meltdown is really just a storeroom, and there are posts in the middle of the room, and the ceilings are super
Acme,
low.
Acme in Minneapolis, same way, which, by the way,
is it
support,
stay?
If you're listening to this, support petitions online to keep Acme open.
Yeah.
What?
It's one of those.
Who's trying to close it?
Well, it's fucking like, it's the same thing that we talk about in the movie. In Don't Think Twice, the beginning of the movie is they lose their lease on their small theater because it's like, it is prophetic, weirdly prophetic, a Trump building coming in. But it's happening across the country, sort of the Trumpification of towns where they move in condos or whatever to places that are cool. The reason they're cool is because of comedy clubs like Acme Comedy Club, and then they can't afford to stay in the place that they made.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's like, you know, the building that Meltdown is in, is there's always rumors bubbling up because of what's happening in Hollywood. They're just tearing down buildings and putting
Well, the crazy thing is, if you take out the cool places to go and you just put an apartment, sooner or later people are going to go, well, it sucks to live here because there's nothing to do, so let's move out.
And yeah, but you might get a Tender back. Greens.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
Yeah. Yeah, you might.
Oh, the salads are so good.
But rooms like that are always in, the Comedy Attic in Bloomington is another example of, like, it's an oddly shaped room. It's kind
Laughing
of
Skull.
Laughing
75
Skull.
Seats.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, this idea of quiet success of, you know, can you sell enough tickets on the – I mean, I think it really boils down to – I've really come to define success lately as the most success I think you can ever ask for is do you like everything you're doing, and do you not have to do anything to – do you not have to take any job to survive?
Yeah.
And if the answer is yes, I like what I'm doing, no, I don't have to do anything to survive and I'm fine, that's about, you know, like, no matter what the dollar amounts are, that's about as successful as you, because I think we quantify it with money or, like you said, visibility, but ultimately it really boils down to, do you like what you're doing?
Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. And no amount of money is going to make you like something better that you don't like doing, you know. So
I remember a long time ago, I was working somewhere, and Jason Alexander came up, and people were like, "Whatever happened to that guy, huh?"
Right.
Like, oh, I guess
you mean
he's just
on Broadway.
Yeah, and that's the thing. And it goes back to your thing about it's visibility that these people are projecting on. It's like, if I can't see him, they're not doing well. But like, he made a bunch of money on a sitcom, and then he went back to just doing stage stuff, and he's probably pretty happy.
Yeah,
unless he needs the visibility.
Well, the visibility isn't really – it's just sort of a weird business because, the visibility helps in the sense that you might get more work opportunities because, you know, companies, networks, whatever, film companies. That guy's in – I've seen him in stuff. Let's get him in a thing.
Yeah.
So it does provide more opportunities. But in terms of any kind of real value that it has, it doesn't have any, like – there's no real value or substance to being in a lot of magazines or tabloids or whatever. And even, you know, I even think in Schumer's case, I think it probably is not fun for her because she has started to appear in tabloids. And now it's tough for her just to be the comic that she was because everything is put under a microscope. And it seems like
I was on tour with her for Trainwreck last summer and it was like traveling with the Beatles and where people would – it would be the cliche of like people like banging on the window of the SUV kind of thing.
Or like the guy
wild. I did not envy
kind of
that.
Kind of grabbed her and was like, I own you. You need to take this picture with me. Like, well, she's a human being and she's not
– That's why I like really respect people like – and if people aren't familiar with him, look him up. Daniel Kitson is a
British comic.
He's one of the greats and – He doesn't do TV specials. He doesn't do talk shows. He just decided a certain – and he's extremely popular.
Yeah.
One of the most highly regarded comedians in the world, but most people haven't heard of him.
Right.
Makes a great living.
Yeah. Although the UK – I think UK comedy – I'm always a little jealous of it because basically
long form pieces.
Well, not only that, but the landmass, you know, it's like – you know, if you could just perform in California and you could hit – You could just keep touring.
No, I know. Jimmy Carr was 200 dates a year in theaters all over the UK, and he wasn't leaving the UK.
Yeah. God damn, everything's probably just a few hours away by train.
Yeah.
But, you know, a lot of the stuff, the idea of success and what people want out of performing is talked about in Don't Think Twice.
Yeah.
Where you kind of took a improv group, and each one of them has a different idea of what they want to do creatively and what it takes. And that, like, did you kind of just base that off of different facets of your own ego or like people that you think about?
It's definitely pieces of me. Like when I look, like who I aspire to be is like Gillian's character, Sam.
Yeah. Like just like, let's do it for the
full
reason
integrity,
of doing it.
Full artistic.
She's like the heir to Del.
Del Close kind of thing. Yeah. And then Keegan's character is very ambitious, and I have that. I directed 2 movies, for God's sake.
Yeah.
You have to have some ambition.
Yeah.
Well, and legendarily, you're the guy who rented an office and said, I'm going to write from 9 to 5 like it's a job, and, you know, and really treat it seriously and not just, you know, hope that I come up with stuff.
Yeah, but you did also have that guilt that comes with success, like leaving, you know, some friends behind
where
the character, they're like, oh, we're all going to check out this new theater space. And he's like, maybe I don't go right now to the TV show.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I was, the idea came out of this thing where after I directed Sleepwalk With Me, I was kind of, I'm sure you guys do this after you finish like a big thing, you're like, how did that happen?
Yeah.
Like you look back and you go, how did I complete all those things? Because directing a movie is like unimaginably difficult because you're essentially executing 9 art forms simultaneously on the screen between music and acting and sound design and production design and photography. And you're like, how the heck? I'm not equipped to do that. How do I know how to do 9 art forms? Well, a lot of it was from being in an improv troupe my freshman year in college. And learning, you know, Sharna Halperin came to campus with Improv Olympic and taught workshops. And we learned, like, say yes. And it's all about the group and all these principles. And I'm like, oh, that's how I knew how to direct a movie. Because I knew I had in my bones from when I was, like, a kid that collaboration is key.
Yeah.
And, like, listening is key. And so I veered back towards doing a regular show at the Upper Citizens Brigade in New York with Chris Gethard and Tammy Sager, who were in the movie. And then on any given week, it would be like A.D. Bryant if she was around, or Vanessa Bayer, or like Connor Ratliff. Yeah.
I've been thinking about doing that out here for
you.
I miss it so much.
I love it. I love it because it's not, you know, you don't prepare. It's, you know, you just, it might go well. It might not go well. It costs $5. No apologies if it's not good.
Yeah.
I love that aspect of it. And then I started doing this improv show. And then my wife made this observation when she saw us one night. I think it was like that night. It was like a really great. It was like Ellie Kemper and A.D. Bryant, like a bunch of people. And my wife goes, it's amazing to watch this group because everyone's sort of equally funny and talented, but yet like she's a cast member on SNL and she's a movie star. And this person lives on an air mattress in Queens.
Yeah.
And when she said that, I just thought, oh my God, that's a movie. I just wanted to see that as a movie. And so I just started writing it kind of feverishly over the course of, you know, a few months. And then after I had a draft, it was over the refining it over a year and a half. And
were you writing it while you were doing Thank God for Jokes?
Yeah, yeah. And
because that was like a pretty down set show.
Yep. Yeah. So I did 100 cities with Thank God for Jokes, and then I sat at Off Broadway.
So it was set. Like year. You could just show up and do the show. Days were kind of, your brain was a bit more free.
Yeah, and I would write, you know, I would go to a coffee shop from like 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. and write. I always try to write before I'm afraid of the world.
that's a great way to say that.
I shut off my internet, I shut off the email, and I try to write, you know, I think there's a Ginsberg line, it's like first thought, best thought. Just like put it on the page, like whatever comes out, and then edit later. It's like the Hemingway thing, like write drunk, edit sober.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't drink, but like that, but I don't like drink that. Like Hemingway. Yeah. But
more like Mickey Mantle.
But you know, in my case, it's like write sleepy.
Yeah.
Edit awake. It's, you know, really, I try to write early before I'm like, I literally am not fully awake when I was writing this screenplay. That's when some of the best stuff comes out.
It's funny to hear you say when you finish a big thing like that, you go, how did I do all that? My first thought is always, how do I do that again? Like, please. I have no idea how I'm going to do that again. Maybe I'm out of, and I think one of the fun things about having done comedy for so long was getting to that point where I was like, oh, you know, jokes aren't all that precious. You know, it's mm-hmm. like they're, you know, some of them work, some of them don't.
Yeah.
One doesn't. You know, maybe I don't, you know, it's thinking I should know all of the jokes in the world now and not, hey, man, I'll discover some tomorrow, next
week on
stage.
Well, that's what people keep asking me in interviews, what's next? And I just say, I'm going to hang out with my wife and daughter for a while. Is that we don't have a title for it.
Life, I think. Right?
But we did start a Twitter account.
There's going to be some Instagram videos, daily
some Snapchats,
vlogs.
We have a development deal. Yeah.
It's funny because I have a hard time being in Los Angeles, which is where we are right now.
That explains the fidgeting and the
irritable.
No, I'm
relaxed.
Starting to undress.
I have a hard. I analyzed it because, you know, I have a lot of friends here, you guys and Mulaney and Kroll and a bunch of people, and I sort of analyzed it and I realized that it's Hollywood itself that I have a hard time in because you're looked at for what your value is,
right?
And I have a very low value. I don't make people a lot of money, and so it makes me feel bad when people treat me based on my value. And so, you know, I'm staying with friends in Manhattan Beach, and my wife and daughter and I go to the beach in the morning, like at 8 o'clock, and then I head here for work. It's a long drive, but it's like we get to have like.
Well, let me ask you this, because you have that career track where you genuinely work on stuff you care about and you make stuff that you love, and it all does. I feel like it does well, actually, because you know, like, you get to keep doing.
Yes, no, and that's the bottom line. It's, but it'll doing be, well enough that I get to make more.
But it'll be one of those things where I bet eventually.
I know where this is going.
But
that I'll sell out in some way, and the studios will say, you know, what you could do is make a movie for $30 million.
No. I think what'll end up happening is one of these things you make is gonna catch fire in a way where it's like Mike Birbiglia was nominated for an Academy Award for this thing, you know, and then all of a sudden all of those value hunters
are going to knock on the door.
And so are you going to be okay with that? Will you process it? Will you reject it? Will you embrace it? Can you compromise with it?
It's a great question. And I think that ultimately I think you have to do what you love and not what you like in order to continue making something you're proud of. Like whenever I like send some, you know, if I say to my Twitter followers or my Facebook friends, like I really would appreciate it if you come out to this. I make sure that it's like really, really good, or it's the best I can do.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's a sacred bond in some ways. Like your relationship with your fans is like, it matters if the stuff you're putting out is good. And I've kind of leaned away from doing stuff that I can't put my name on at all. And so as long as if those people come knocking on my door, what I'll say is the same thing that I said to, you know, this movie has a higher budget than my first film. And I, you know, I wanted, yeah, I'd love to make a movie with you guys. It's this awesome company, Cold Iron Pictures and Film Arcade. I need to have final cut on the movie. I need to have final approval of actors. Like, there's all this stuff that in even like I had final cut of like trailer and poster because I can't handle people like marketing in a way that makes me cringe.
Right.
You know, sometimes you see like great comedians and then their poster for their thing is just like, ooh. Yeah.
Right.
That's kind of painful.
Yeah. Well, especially if they don't.
Which one would you think is painful the most?
No,
yeah. You must have a top five.
Wait, what are you guys
doing? No, I'm just saying. Like,
nothing.
Was it like maybe one for like, like a Madison Square Garden poster?
Oh, you're trying to get me to.
No. We're just having a conversation. Yeah. We're just trying to find out what
you're friends.
Like
it's us.
You know, like,
the other two Sandlers.
Yeah.
It was a Chris Hardwick poster.
What?
Gotcha!
Oh my God! No!
Yeah. I fucking knew it.
Yeah, I knew it too, and I got him, and now I feel bad.
it's a fun, comfortable poster. That was my only way out of this. Because we're looking into each other's eyes.
We're staring at each other's eyes. Yeah. Well, that was. You know, I just got back from Comic-Con, and that was the thing you just said made me realize why I cherish experiences like. Comic-Con is, I feel like, so, and it's also one of the reasons why I've been playing so much Pokemon Go, is that so many of our experiences are conditioning us to isolate ourselves from everyone.
Yes.
Even though you're connected to billions of people ostensibly on the internet, you're still really just, you know, like a lot of times you're interfacing with it alone, and you're interfacing with a machine and text. It's all very cold, and, you know, it's very depersonalized. And so experiences where you have to go out and interact with people and look them in the eye and engage and be part of a community, which is very much in the spirit of improv.
Yeah.
I feel like is really, I mean, it's effort, but I feel like it's really, really, really important.
It's so important. I always say whenever we are out doing these improv workshops, there's this line from, there's a great oral history book of the history of Second City and the Compass Players. It's like this thick.
Yeah.
It's called Something Wonderful Right Away. And it's got like, you know, it's a good thing to have on your nightstand because it'll be like a chapter of Alan Arkin talking.
Yeah,
A chapter of Elaine May just talking, you know, and it's really candid because it's from like 1981.
Mm-hmm.
It was like before they knew to censor themselves. So they'll like throw each other under the bus. It's like Ann Mira and Mike Nichols all these people. And there's, you know, Severin Dard and all these people saying like, some pretty critical things, but they're all, I think it was Paul Sills who said, and I completely believe this, is like on any given night, anywhere in the country, whether you're in Phoenix or San Francisco or Chicago, you can create on stage with improv, and this goes for any, you know, piece of theater, you can create the best performed, best written, most topical, provocative, and thoughtful piece of theater that exists that night anywhere on earth.
Yeah.
And that's pretty powerful to think about that opportunity.
Well, and because a lot of it has to do with, and also, you know, if you do, it's the same. You don't do any crowd work. Do you do much crowd work at all?
I did, yeah, in my Thank God for Joke show, I did a bit where, because I talk about being arrested and I ask people if they've ever been arrested. And so it's fun. Every night it's a different person being arrested for something. It's a great story.
Well, improv is all basically an extension of crowd work.
Yeah.
And what's, if you do a lot of crowd work, which I do, you find that it can be hard to follow your crowd work with your written material because,
oh my God,
your crowd work and the improv is all about that group, that moment in time. It's all about that moment in time.
So yeah. Now you can get.
Yeah, and it makes it really special, you know, especially with an improv, it makes it really special because that's all, it's all happening together, the entire lifespan, the birth of the thing. You know, it's all the way through its death at the end.
Yes.
It's all right there. And I feel like it's harder to. I mean, I feel like that can be so much more special than writing something and hoping that people connect with it in a way.
Yeah.
There was last night I watched Don't Think Twice, and I followed it up with the Thank You Dell documentary.
Oh yeah, that's a great one.
Yeah, it was a nice little improv movie.
Todd Bieber's documentary.
Yeah, it's fantastic. But there is footage of Dell directing a show at George Wendt is in it. I think Tim Kazurinsky
is in
it.
That's right. Yeah.
He's directing a show at Second City.
It's got great footage.
It's amazing. Like tons of stuff and like a cool story within it about this group from Missouri that came out to do the Dell Close Marathon. It's a really great movie.
But like, there's this amazing moment where Del comes up and he's like, "All right, let's run it again, but just, and this is going to sound silly, but let's try to remember that we improvised this at one point. And let's try to remember that it was like a real live thing.
A live thing, yeah.
And that's, and I want to know, like, with the movie, the improv scenes that you guys did, you had some good angles on it, and they looked like well lit. But they still felt that they were real improv.
The goal was, you know, with my cinematographer, Joe Anderson, is like, we wanted to shoot improv a way that it's never been shot before. We shot a Steadicam on the stage from the perspective of one of the other improvisers. So it feels like a dance sequence or a fight sequence. And so these feel like your friends. And then in terms of like what was improvised and what wasn't, we basically, I had written out the improv scenes, and then while we were in those costumes, we would just do real improv for 10 minutes in each costume. Perfect. And so it's, that stuff is sprinkled in. But when you work with Chris Gethard and Tammy Sager, it's like lights out.
And it can be so hard. It's so challenging to capture improv on camera, because it's kind of like shooting a magic trick.
I know.
Where people feel like there's something in their brains that goes, oh, but it's shot, so it's probably like they lose that sense of the magic of the moment.
Well, the key for that you're right, and that's what we're trying to make the improv more about friendship than about comedy. Yeah. So in other words, that it doesn't really matter if the improv is funny, but it matters if it feels like these are our friends, because the movie is a lot about friendship, and it's about how often, you know, friends, like when I was writing the movie, I wrote this phrase on my wall. I wrote, art is socialism, but life is capitalism.
It makes perfect sense.
No one ever says it in the movie, but it was like the guiding principle for all the scenes. It's like, what's a movie like that? Like, where you see that, like, this group of best friends, which is like, they're called the commune. What happens when someone gets SNL? Someone, you know, is getting opportunities that other people don't, and so the friendship is the key, because I think that's, you know, what I'm finding is like people in their 20s and 30s are seeing it and they're like, oh, that's like my life, and that's kind of crushing.
Yeah, some scenes were pretty brutal, like pretty just like, oh.
And then some people are like 70 or 80 and are like, oh, that's what my life was like in my 20s and 30s. Yeah. And that, like, I want it to feel like your friends.
Yeah.
So that's why we sort of filmed it in that way. But, I mean, it's – what's funny is like, we were talking before about, like, what's popular versus, like, what you like. I think that's how you framed it, is, like – or what's good. Yeah. And I feel like
– to you.
One of the goals of this movie was make a film that I want to see. And I feel like movies that are dramatic and comedic are not really greenlit in the studio system right now. Yeah. I feel like movies like The Big Chill and Hannah and Her Sisters and Broadcast News are like, in the 70s and 80s, they used to be studio films, and now they're indie films.
Yeah.
And it's like kind of a bummer. Like, even a movie like Almost Famous is like, I feel like that movie's not being made right
now. Well, because the studios are run by marketing departments now, and I think they don't know how to market something like that. Well, how do we market? Is it? You know, who was the worst improviser in the group?
Oh,
gotcha!
It starts with an O or has an O in the name.
No, you know who's amazing though? The movie's Gillian Jacobs had never improvised before, and she's phenomenal.
Really?
She
was phenomenal. Yeah. I mean, really, because whenever she's been on At Midnight, she's fucking amazing.
Yes.
Amazing.
She's like a classically trained actress.
Yes,
right?
Yeah. She went to Juilliard.
Yeah,
famously had a. She wrote a piece for Lena Dunham's newsletter, about her stressful experience at Juilliard. She was like, they kept threatening to cut her out of the program and stuff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she had a really rough time.
Oh, she's so funny.
Yeah. She's unbelievable. I think she's like on her way to being like a major movie star. See, same with Keegan. I feel like Keegan-Michael Key and Gillian Jacobs, I got so lucky that I'm just like, I caught them right before they're going to... I mean, Keegan's already kind of a major star, but...
They were great. Their relationship felt really real. And, you know, I enjoyed that scene towards the end of the movie that they did, where it was like the really emotional scene.
Yes.
And it was just... it's funny because when it first revealed that they were together, I guess because I know them both, I was just kind of like, oh, they're kissing.
They're kissing.
But then, like, they're such grounded, and that's what makes them such good comedic actors, is that they ground everything in, like, the most truth.
McKean's a classically trained actor before he was a sketch comedian.
Well, I think, by the way, I saw on Obscure Media, which is a subreddit that I adore.
Yeah.
Someone posted a 1985. It was Tom Brokaw was doing a story on Jim Varney. He was a story on Jim Varney, who's the Ernest, and it was right when the
Is this the same guy who did Three Sandlers?
This is the Three Sandlers guy?
He does Brokaw also?
We're the two Brokaws.
I have a lot of rain from Brokaw to Sandler. The three Brokaws?
I don't know about that. After the break.
So they showed this. So that it was right when the Ernest commercials took off, and it was done. When you see how they were made, it's very much like how kind of like, you know, the viral low-end campaigns are made now. A guy came up with a character who's not Jim Varney. They shot all the stuff at his house, like in South Carolina. But there's all this footage of Jim Varney doing Shakespeare, and it is fucking incredible.
Yeah.
He is and even at the very end, he does this in this soliloquy and then looks down at the camera and goes, know what I mean?
Oh my God.
And it's so mind-bending, but you realize, you know, it's sort of what makes really great artists great is that you don't see the infrastructure behind that. You don't see
Larry the Cable Guy is a
classically trained.
Yeah, he was in the Footlights.
he played the Guthrie for years.
Yes.
you mean Sir Lawrence, the cable fellow?
Sir Lawrence the Cable Fellow.
Sir Lawrence the Cable Fellow. Hashtag yeah. Sir Lawrence the Cable Fellow.
But I think,
please be finished. That's, you know, get her done.
I think part of what the
please hashtag go on.
But I think part of this idea of art being socialism and life being capitalism is that the capitalism part is kind of where the ego lives. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think part of the artist's main struggle is really kind of dealing with the ego stuff,
yeah,
and getting it out of the way, or figuring out how to make friends with it, or figuring out how to compromise with it, because all those issues, you know, all those issues that kind of arise, especially when a group, which is essentially a band,
yeah,
starts, you know, it's a lot of the ego stuff. You know, how can you not feel, oh, he's getting a little more attention than I am, or she's getting a little more,
and
I feel weird.
And also there's this sense of like, there, you have to realize at a certain point that if you're trying to get to the top in art, there is no top. Literally.
So it's the top of what?
Of what? And so, like, I heard this interview once with the guy who wrote Beautiful Girls and a lot of other stuff, like a bunch of Nick Cage stuff. And he was saying he was in Nick Cage's, like, trailer, like in Arizona on a movie. In the 90s, and it was right after, like, Leaving Las Vegas. Maybe he won an Oscar, was nominated for an Oscar. Like, top of the world, doing, yeah, like, studio films and films with integrity and being nominated for awards or winning awards. And like, a TV commercial came. And they're in a trailer that literally, he said at the time, was bigger than my apartment in New York City. And there's, like, Nick Cage. They turn on the TV, and there's a commercial for Tom Cruise in some movie or whatever. And he's like, how am I not Tom Cruise?
Oh my God.
That is, it's a, Dimitri Martin told me a story once where he was talking with Albert Brooks, and then Steve Martin came up, and Albert Brooks got visibly
Are there
upset.
More name drops in this story?
There could be. No.
Jonah was telling that to his friend Mark Hoppus in Blink
182. Yeah. That made sense in the conversation, though.
Yeah.
And so does this.
Yeah, of course.
Sorry, a friend of mine was talking to Albert Brooks. What do you guys do when you hear that? Who's your friend?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Who was the guy who came up?
It.
Gotcha, Jonah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think it's part of it is, you know.
But hold on.
Finish my thing.
You got to let him tell the story that the name drops seven people.
It literally is in context to everything we're talking about.
Yes.
But it's, sorry, my friend wasn't on set with fucking Nick Cage.
I heard.
I don't know why you're attacking Mike. He was just telling a story that totally made sense within the context of the conversation.
So does this.
It would be It would be funny if you guys had a separate Nerdist podcast that was just like inappropriate segues.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Where it's just like, here's the footage that got cut out.
Yeah, yeah. That would be most of the episodes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah, we record like 3-4 hours of this, yeah, and yeah, we just cut out to the most usable 50
and then the real nerds are like, you know what's actually great is Nerdist inappropriate aside.
It's even it's better.
It's exactly much better than the real show.
Yeah. But the fact is, Albert Brooks, like Steve Martin came up like in conversation, and he got visibly upset. He's like, that motherfucker. Like he you know, they're both comedy legends, right, but he still has an issue against Steve Martin.
Oh, well, I think
to this day,
I think it probably, you know, humans measure gains in terms of relative gains.
Sure.
It's like they don't, humans don't really, I don't think they really appreciate absolute gains. Yes. You don't go, you know, if someone gives you $100,000, you go, oh my God, they gave me $100,000. And you find out they gave your neighbor $200,000. You'd be like, oh, why did he get $200,000? You know, it's like people are just kind of wired that way. And I don't know what the, I'm sure there's some I'm sure there's some sort of evolutionary function to, maybe it's.
Chris Gethard always says, he goes, if you, you know, when you look at your friend who your neighbor who has an in-ground pool, you're like, how come I have an above-ground pool?
Right.
Yeah.
It's so stupid, but we all have this weird jealousy thing.
I don't, you know, I think part of it is, I think honestly, part of it is this, the need to kind of be a part of a community, but also be significant in your community.
Yeah.
Because there is that, you know, and maybe it's just all mating ritual stuff. It's like, oh, if I am significant, then I will attract the best mate, and I will appreciate.
Could be, yeah.
I will spread my genes will be the most dominant genes, and you know, maybe that just trickles down to shit like that, and maybe that's what that is. It's just a sort of an outcropping of that dumb, you know.
And the fullest realization of that is Orphan Black.
Yeah,
17 clones of oneself,
all the clones, all the time. But you know, I don't know. It's like, how do you kind of wipe the ego stuff out of the way and focus on the work?
I try to, but it's, you know, obviously I made a whole movie about jealousy. It's on my mind.
Right. Are you particularly jealous of something at the moment that you're dealing with?
No, I weirdly feel, thanks to the folks, you know, who've seen the movie and have come to the shows in the last few years, like I weirdly feel like I'm completely content, and as long as I can just keep making stuff like this. And yeah, I mean, I feel like for a long time I was frustrated because I hadn't sort of I hadn't found what it is I'm sort of meant to do. I feel like now I'm like, oh, okay, this, I'd like to make movies and solo shows and specials, and kind of that's what I do.
Do you think it's good? I feel like there's some part that's good because I do think there is a form of competitiveness that's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
When it makes you strive to be better, I think it's good. When it makes you try to crush people and salt the earth, then it's bad. Or when it leads to jealousy and rage spirals and hate, you know, then it's all bad. But I do believe, because I know without naming them, and don't try to get me because I'm the host of the Gotcha podcast.
No, keep an eye on it.
I know comics who have played the coveted Madison Square Garden.
Yes, the best comedy room.
The best comedy that we've all agreed.
The tallest ceilings.
Yeah, the tallest ceilings.
The finest bathrooms.
And the longest, and the name is long.
Good popcorn, too.
Yeah.
That's what I want at a comedy show.
That they will kind of go like, oh, but you know, I'm not Zach Galifianakis, or I'm not someone who can do like the alternative rooms, or there's always something. But is there an element to that that's good because it always makes you strive to be better, hopefully?
I think so. I think you know, and that's the Malcolm Gladwell theory of the two books ago. I'm forgetting
the tipping point.
No, the other
blink.
One.
The blink.
Outliers.
The dog wars.
Outliers. Is all about like groupings of people,
right,
who force each other to kind of rise up, like, you know, be better than the other person, and that person tries to be better than that person, and the competitiveness actually does create good pockets of art and science and whatnot.
Yeah, but do you think it's competition or inspiration they don't want to admit to?
What do you mean inspiration you don't want to admit to?
So if it's someone, if it is it could be competition.
You mean Carlos Mencia's inspiration?
No, I meant...
No. It's just Jonah's talking to, you know, one of his friends, like, yeah, you know, Catherine O'Hara or Albert Brooks.
Okay.
Yeah, these are close personal friends of mine.
Yeah.
And they're a part of my life. So it's weird that you would make fun of me for bringing them up. You keep on saying Chris Gethard, a man that I DM'd with 2 days ago.
Oh, wow.
Oh, fine, yeah, Jonah. Yeah, yeah. You know him, too. Yeah.
Look at
him. I've met him.
Yeah.
He's been on At Midnight.
Yeah, he has. that was me struggling to remember what I was going to try and say.
Well, you were talking about how you're...
Oh, yeah, so everyone's doing stuff at the same time. Is it competition? It's like, I'm going to be better than that person? Or it's like, hey, I kind of like what they're doing. I might try to do something like in the same way.
I think that happens all the time.
Yeah, but is it...
I see, yeah.
Does it have to be competition, though? Does it have to be, I'm going to best you?
I don't think competition is inherently good or bad. I think it's what your intentions are,
yeah,
you know? I think there is healthy competition to... That's really amazing. That, in turn, inspires me to try to be better for myself or to try to see if I can reach higher than I thought I could before.
Yeah, you even look at, like, the 2000s of the comedy boom, and a lot of it... It goes back to Dane Cook.
Yeah.
He was the first of all of these folks to be like, of all these comedians, to be like, I'm going to connect with my fans on the internet.
Yeah.
And then if you track back, you go, would Louis C.K. have been as popular if he didn't notice what Dane Cook was doing with his fans on the internet?
So it all goes back to him.
Does it? I don't
Patient
know.
Zero?
I don't know.
Does it? I mean...
Yeah.
I mean, I know that there's a lot. I mean, there's that great Dane Louis episode,
yeah,
where you know they're they have frustrations with each other because I think in real life Louis trashed Dane on something.
Like people on YouTube were putting their bits side by side and
itchy
saying
asshole or something.
Yeah, yeah, and they were saying Dane stole from it.
But meanwhile, my wife made this observation that was one of the things that inspired me to write the film was when she came to my improv show. She was like. One night she goes, your stand-up friends are so mean to each other and your improv friends are so nice to each other. Yeah. And I just thought, I was like, it's true, but it's more complicated than that. I think it's, with improvisers, it's a little more under the surface.
Yeah, it's like Minnesota nice.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, or Chicago
yeah.
nice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Midwest.
Yeah, it's Midwest nice. But I think with improvisers, it's like, it's very competitive. A lot of people vying for the same stuff.
Yeah.
But stand-ups will just straight up go after each other.
Yeah. Stand-up is definitely the solo act versus the band.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, although in an improv group, though, whereas a band might have different members who are more in the background or more in the foreground, an improv group really is kind of a...
It's
an organism. And it functions exactly the way it does because of that group of people.
Yeah.
And any rotating in or out changes the chemistry of the group.
I saw this group this week at UCB Theater in New York at a Herald Night called Women and Men. And we had actually, Liz Allen and I had done a little workshop with them like a few weeks ago. And I was just like, oh, they're too good. Like, they're going to break up in like 3 weeks. Like, sometimes you see an improv group and you're like, they can't last because they're too good.
Should an improv group last, or do you feel like that it should, that they all should, that it is an experience of a period of time?
I think it's an experience of a period of time. I mean, you look at, like, I look at my favorite, like, improv groups, and, you know, Upright Citizens Brigade, the original four, were incredible. You'd probably see them in the late 90s. You and I were both in New York in the late 90s seeing comedy.
Early 2000s, yeah.
Early 2000s, where they would do ASCAT, and it would just be like, I literally can't believe that this is improvised. It's so good. The Swarm was like that at UCB.
The Swarm was great.
The Stepfathers, which Gethard was in.
Yeah. Beer Shark Mice.
I mean, see, that's an example of, like, every once in a while, Beer Shark Mice get back together and do a show.
Or even, like, it's sketch, but, like, The State is, like, outrageously good. And Stella was outrageously good. There's certain groups where you're like, and to your point, like, I don't know if they can stay together. There's too many dynamics that
there's
are splitting
too many dynamics
them apart.
And people grow and people change and sooner or later they, you know, but it's almost like the improv world
It's just kind of like this lava lamp of like breaking apart, coming back together, pieces going over here, coming back together. But I think it is...
TJ and Dave is like that. You know, that's just a two-person group, but like phenomenal. They've been together for, I don't know, 15 years.
Are you going to do more improv now that you did this movie, or are you done? Are you like, okay, I did it, that's
well,
it.
I had like a weekly show at UCB in New York for a while, Mike Birbiglia's Dream, and I'll probably come back with it because I just enjoy it so much. I enjoy... the, you know, not being in my head.
Yeah.
How does it affect your writing?
I think that it makes me, it trains me to not censor myself. I think that one of the biggest mistakes any of us make as writers is that we hold ourselves back, that we judge our thoughts. That's why I was saying I like to write when I'm kind of half asleep, because you don't judge your thoughts. You just write it all down. There's something about like, sometimes you write something, as you guys know, you write something and you're like, if people saw this. Yeah. I mean, I have
it's all
hundreds
over.
Of pages of notebooks that would end my career.
Yeah. But it, but in that sense, it's sort of like just in that sense, it's sort of like a diary. You know,
it is a diary.
Yeah.
I mean, some
still your thoughts on paper.
A lot of my best stuff is like is stuff that I write in my journal at night secretly, and then eventually I read through it and I'm like, I could try to say that on stage.
Well, what's the worst thing you've written in the last 6 months?
Oh, gosh. I mean, my whole thing lately has just been about, like, what I write in my diary is that my, you know, I have a daughter who's 14 months and, you know, when you have a child, it's, you're jealous of your daughter. Like, you're, like, because you have your wife and your daughter and they love each other so much, and you're there too. You know, you're just like this milkless, pudgy loser. You're essentially the vice president of the family. It's like huge title, no power, also oversees Congress. And that's sort of like the essence of my journal for the last few months, and I'll probably end up writing a lot more about that. Just about how, like, you feel, like, envy towards your...
Mike Birbiglia hates daughter, jealous of subjugation. Gotcha!
Oh, man!
God damn it!
I knew it! I should have... No, but it's, it's tough. It's you, and you, like, with children, you just, when you have a child, you just experience all these things where it's an unstabilizing experience, and that's actually what's wonderful about it and what's hard about it. It's destabilizing. That's why I didn't want to have a kid for a long time. That's why I didn't want to get married for a long time. All these things I didn't want to do were, in a lot of ways, the best thing that could have ever happened to me, which is to say, like, one of the guiding principles when I wrote Don't Think Twice was, like, what happens when life gets in the way of dreams? And in some ways, like, that's what my experience has been, like, being married and having kids. It's like, that's my life. And my dream would be that everything is controlled and I work this many hours a day and this many hours a week and I'm, you know, I create this many movies per year, this many one-person shows. And it's like, no, it's actually good to shake that up and be like, maybe that's not going to happen.
Yeah. And if you did have that, I don't think – I just feel like people rarely know what's good for them. You know, people rarely know what's going to make them happy because you just kind of have these idealized versions in your head of like, oh, if I do this thing and follow this ritual or follow this band, then everything will be amazing. And then you do it and you're like, I feel empty. I feel weird. Yeah. Something's not right.
We're all going to be dead in like – 20 or 30 years anyway.
God, like, really?
Jonah, I have some news.
Oh, God, why now?
Well,
is it the cancer or the AIDS?
Gotcha. Gotcha, Jonah.
I don't have either?
Well, at the end, we'll tell you.
All right. Tune in next week.
We'll be right back.
Out.
No, but it's like, you know, sometimes I think in those terms, it's like we're all going to be dead in 20 or 30 years. And it's like, I will be lucky if I make one thing that endures in some way. And so it's like, why should I be obsessing over us a comedy? Like, I get so mad that Louis, like, I love Louis, but like, he's the only person who can pull off doing a special a year. Like, everyone else was like, me too, and it's like, nope. You should not be doing that.
Can I say
slow
something
down,
though?
Fella, to be named later.
You know, I gotta. I
poor
do,
lady.
I do want to say something. I do want to say something without starting. I do, literally don't want to start any crazy thing because I, you know, I'm a huge fan of Louis. But there are times where I feel like the race to put out a special a year. There are moments or bits of his where I'm like, oh, I just wanted to see that more developed, or
It's the same as Woody Allen movies.
Well, exactly. Yeah. I just wanted to see a little more of that. I mean, that's just my personal preference. Like, oh, just one more year of like really, because he's such a he's such a deep thinker,
yes.
And he really does write complex bits. And I mean, I think to the race to get an hour out every year, it's like some stuff just, you know, I think some stuff just sort of ends with like. And then I took a shit in her face, you know, and then it. And I feel like, oh, that could have.
Can I use that, by the way?
Yeah.
That's a good bet.
Okay, yeah. Cool. But again, you know, not at all shitting on Louis at all. I'm saying as a fan of his, there are some bits that I feel like, oh, I wanted to see how much further that one could have gone.
People ask me that a lot. Like, I'm doing interviews with a lot of film journalists right now, and a lot of them who followed Sleepwalk with me and then watched this are like, can we have it faster than 4 years for the next one? And I'm like, I don't know.
Has
like,
it been 4 years?
Yeah, 2012, 2016, yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, and it's like, I'm trying. I'm going as fast as I can, but at the same time, like, I want to make something for you that you'll watch.
The George R. R. Martin of comedy, Mike Birbiglia.
Yeah. I want to make something that you guys will watch 6 times and not once.
Right.
Yeah.
It's not a volume thing.
Yeah, I mean, there was a band I really liked, got into their first album, came out, and then they kind of started putting out an album a year, and I lost track and got overwhelmed with how many there were, and I kind of didn't listen to them as much as the band that put out an album every 4 years.
Well, what's Radiohead at? Like 4 or 5 years?
I think so.
No, they just... Oh.
No, in terms of their per... How many per year or per decade or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
about that. Probably 4 or 5.
Yeah. It's a chunk of time.
Yeah. To like experience life and be able to...
Well, King of Limbs came out in what, 2011? 2010? 2011?
Yeah. That's like 6 years.
Yeah, and then the most recent one just came out. But in Rainbows, it was a few years before the last... Yeah.
That was like 4 or 5 years before that.
Wow, yeah. I mean, it really just takes as long as it takes.
It takes as long as it takes, yeah. Yeah, and that's what I get in all the interviews is people going, what's next? And like I said earlier, it's like, yeah, I just want to hang out with my family.
Yeah,
and then hopefully something comes out.
But that's the thing,
you know, it's something like comes to me.
The world wants they just want their content.
Yes.
It seems they don't want to wait around for something that's really exciting and something that's been crafted and thought about more than a few times.
That's
before.
What you know. Ritu said in one of his speeches. He goes, "I saw him at the, like Sundance Institute, and he was like, they take our art and they call it content."
Yeah,
and it is such an awesome statement. It's like, yeah, it's like what he's making is great. It's like it shouldn't be viewed as like that's a 90-minute piece of content.
Yeah, but let's. Yeah, but I think we shouldn't kid ourselves that, you know, most of what people are trying to do when they watch or listen to something or play a game or read a book is distract themselves from the shitstorm that this sort of like. I mean, I know there's a lot of bad stuff in the world, but I do think a lot of it is, you know, I do think there's a lot of fear-mongering in news media.
Yeah.
And I think because the level of news content has gone up so much.
Yeah.
More distractions.
That there are more, you know, it's like, and again, there are horrible things happening in the world, but it just paints this picture of just, it's grim, it's hopeless, everything is bleak, it's all about murder, and it's all about... You know, it's all about the worst things you can think of. And I really do think people are overwhelmed. And so the content, art has become content as escapism, like as a daily escapism, you know? So I do kind of understand that. And I think as content creators, we should sort of understand the fact that the audience does want and need
to counterbalance
yeah. and to escape and to find something that where they don't have to, you know...
But there's so many people creating stuff that, you know, we can still take our time. We don't have to be the one person giving them everything. You know, it's like,
right.
Like, you know, Mike puts out a movie this year and then, you know, like next year, I think the new Mike Mills movie comes out. And
right.
Mike Mills' movie, like Beginners came out in 2010.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of my all-time favorite movies.
Oh, my God. It's incredible. We have the same composer.
Oh, really?
Roger Neill. He's phenomenal.
Oh, God. Yeah. But like the new, I'm glad that I had to wait. But in that time, I got, you know...
like a Birbiglia movie or a Taika Waititi movie or you
a
know
Noah Baumbach movie.
Yeah, or Noah Baumbach movie, God. Something like that.
Taika Waititi directing Thor.
That's crazy to me.
That is crazy.
Yeah, then right after that, he's going to make Swearwolves.
Oh my God!
Which is the sequel to What We Do in the Shadows.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. Yes,
I was so excited to hear that he was directing Thor. Like,
yeah,
I found out at Comic-Con. Kevin Feige was like, "Oh, it's being directed by this guy from New Zealand, Taika Waititi." I'm like, Taika Waititi is directing the Thor movie? That's incredible.
Hunt for the Wilder People is fantastic. If you haven't seen
it, I've heard that. The other recommendation I have is Captain Fantastic.
Oh yeah, that's
Fantastic is phenomenal.
Yeah, I just saw the trailer for that before. And
Tickled is great. There's great indie films right now.
Yeah, there's a ton right
Tickled,
now.
Tickled, have you seen Tickled? It'll blow.
Oh, I've heard it. April Richardson told me about it.
I will give it the ultimate recommendation. Don't read about it. Don't
just watch it.
Don't watch the trailer. Just see it.
Oh, I actually just said
that
sincerely.
It's a just see it. It's a just see it movie.
Wait, Miranda Bailey was a producer.
Yep, she's one of our producers.
So Miranda Bailey has been killing it lately.
Yeah,
it's like there's your movie. There was Swiss Army Man, and then she
Diary
of a Teenage Girl.
Yeah.
So I think ultimately that sort of the takeaway is do the stuff you like.
Yes.
Take it seriously. Just do it. Don't judge it before you put it down on, you know, paint to canvas or pen to paper or typing to Evernote or whatever it is that you do. And then, you know, try to enjoy it. I mean, you really should enjoy. I think really the older you get, the more it's like, oh, it's not about all these external things that are going to make you feel better and you're going to try to fit a puzzle piece. That shape is going to fit the puzzle piece of the hole in your soul.
Yes.
It's you really just kind of have to enjoy what you're doing, and do you like it, and are you proud of it?
And take it from me, Mike Birbiglia, a person incapable of joy.
Thanks for the sound drop, buddy. We're going to be able to put the station ID on that. It's going to be really good.
Station ID.
Yeah.
This is Z98. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Hardwick and the Jonah on the Gotcha Podcast. Gotcha.
Coming up next. Bringing in the lead.
So Don't Think Twice is actually already out in New York.
Yep.
As of the
New York,
of
Los Angeles at the Landmark, and Chicago at the Music Box. And then the more people come see it, the more cities we'll be in.
Oh, question. Yeah. How will you define whether or not this movie was a successful endeavor?
Thank you, my wife, for asking that question. That discussion happens 3 times a day to this insatiable hole of a personality that I am.
When will you stop?
I'm going to... I was texting with Judd Apatow a few nights ago. I said,
oh, really?
Why did you just say that? You just threw your sunglasses down on the table because I said my friend's name?
Yeah. Just trying to call back to the name drop thing, and this is why
it wasn't Albert Brooks. It was Judd Apatow.
It was Dimitri Martinez who it was.
Okay, so he said, he said, it's 100% of Rotten Tomatoes. It's crazy. Like, this is crazy. It was like a really nice compliment. And I wrote, like, how do I turn it into box office? And he said, don't stop.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of my life right now. I just can't stop. Because I really believe in it, I love it, and I'm going to spend the next month just traveling the country, going to Seattle and Portland and Denver and Boston and New York and L.A., and I'm just everywhere.
I think you just have to take the victories the same way that you take the losses. I think it's easier to take the losses and don't turn your victories into losses, you know? Mm-hmm. I think it's really hard, you know, for... If something really good happens and Lydia goes, oh, it's really amazing that it happened. I'm like, yeah, but it's not real because this was already, you know, it's like you justify out of it why it's not a win. And it's such a bad habit. And there's no valor in it. There's no valor in beating yourself up and keeping your own foot on your throat.
I wrote one of these great quotes in the walls. I think you have Scott Fitzgerald. He said, when I was writing my movie up on my wall, it said, don't mistake a single defeat for the final defeat.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the key. You tend to get down when you take a loss or whatever. It doesn't, maybe it doesn't do well at the box office or this or that. And it's like, no, that's, maybe it'll live on, and, you know, it'll hit a moment in cable or it'll a moment in whatever. It, people find it in 10 years. That, I, on this podcast, when you guys interviewed Cusack, that really blew my mind when he was like, I don't know for 10 years if a movie is going to hold up.
Yeah.
Or be, you know, he goes, I think he said to you, like, people quote back to me, like, One Crazy Summer. And, like, at the time, like, we all thought it was a disaster.
Right.
And that like, really stuck with me.
Yeah. And
that Cusack podcast, if people haven't heard the interview, listen to that.
He was great. Yeah. He
oh
was
my
really
gosh.
Great. But it was like, we the Rob Zombie, the House of a Thousand Corpses movie. We shot that Rob shot in the year 2000, and at the time, it got shit on. It didn't do very well, but it's one of the things that people now are like, "Oh my god, that movie is like a legendary." And Rob was like, "All it took was 10 years, yeah, you know. All it took was 10 years to go by." Or even I found out Citizen
Spinal,
Kane.
Spinal Tap too. Sorry, Citizen Kane's a better example. But Spinal Tap's
both,
good too. Yeah.
But Spinal Tap
I'd rather
is
watch Spinal Tap on a daily
Spinal
basis.
Spinal Tap's kind of the Citizen Kane of comedies.
Of comedies,
you know. Yes, but right. Both in the same, you know, Citizen Kane got basically crushed by Hearst, and he was right to do it. He was right to do it.
Is that did Hearst himself take it down?
I think he did, or
lot,
I think
a lot of campaigns.
Oh my
and
God.
So, but he was right to do it. He was right to do it. And
Chris, why would you say that?
I just think he was right to do it. I'm just on the right side of things.
Rupert Murdoch of his time.
No, let's not get crazy. Let's not get crazy. Yeah, yeah. He was just a sensible man that would have done what any of us would have done.
Some people say yellow journalism was a good move.
No, anyone would have done the same thing in that situation.
Making hemp illegal.
But, you know, what made it popular was when it started running on television, like 20 years later or 15 years later. And same thing with Twilight Zone, because I've been watching Twilight Zones at night in bed. And still strangely applicable. So many of us think like, oh, our problems are modern problems and they're unlike
any other. Right.
But you watch Twilight Zone and they're basically all morality tales and they're all...
It's Black Mirror.
It is Black Mirror. And they're all so applicable to today with just a slightly different filter. And Ben, that's a show that didn't do very well when it was on television.
Is that right?
Yes. Oh, yeah, wow. That's why they like. I was reading that, you know, every year it was like the show would get canceled and then it would come back and it'd be on the edge. And Rod Serling was kind of this angry. He was kind of known as this angry man in Hollywood.
Yeah,
he died. He died young of a heart attack. He had a heart attack at 50 and died. And
Friday Night Lights.
I mean, there's so
much development.
Friday Night Lights.
Yeah.
No. I'm just saying,
Community.
Like, to build on the points.
Yeah.
Like, there's so many things.
That you just. You don't know, and it's because you can't control the external variance. You really, all you have is the moment to kind of enjoy the thing that you're doing.
And I won't. Thanks for having me.
This has been Mike Vermeulen.
Which dovetails beautifully into Enjoy Your Burrito. Quite literally. I always love having you on, and I really appreciated, you know, it meant the world to me that you, you asked me about my special, and I sent it to you before it came out. And like that night you had watched it, which was amazing, and it really meant a lot to me that you, because I have so much respect for what you do, and so it was one of those things where you're like, oh, I feel validated by someone that I really like. Aww. And it was really nice. It was really nice. I appreciate it.
The feeling is mutual, and hopefully our competition that we both know is in the air will be fruitful for both of us.
I've never directed a movie. I can direct a movie. I don't want to direct a movie. What am I going to direct a movie?
I'm not a
That'll
major,
get you there.
I'm not a major media empire.
I mean, I'm not.
I'm not a singular major media empire that gets New York Times pieces about me.
I don't.
It was just the one piece. It wasn't. I don't.
Can't take compliments.
What do we
do? We like to trying to take a compliment. No one's going to get this reference, but it sort of reminds me of there's a moment in the sequel to fuck, my brain is blanking.
I've never saw the first one.
God damn it.
Kick ass.
Noah's Crossing.
It's a vampire series with the lycans and the werewolf.
Underworld.
Okay. There's a scene in the sequel to Underworld where he is now like this vampire werewolf hybrid, but he hasn't really accepted it yet. So he's really hungry. So he goes and he eats this food, and he's like, "Oh, he's really satisfied." And a second later, he's like, "Wah, wah, wah." I feel like that's what it feels
like a cat.
For people. Yeah, for people like us. To take
like
a compliment.
You can't feed a cat too much food because they throw it up. Yeah. But man, do they want that food.
Yeah, it just comes right back.
Boy, oh boy, can't
like
stop them from that
food. Like a street cat.
Yeah, we want the thing that makes us ill.
Yeah.
I don't know. Just enjoy your life. There's nothing, I told someone at Comic-Con, there's nothing wrong with just being okay. There's nothing wrong with it. It is okay to be okay.
You're going to be dead in 20 years. Thank you.
Nothing matters, and that's A-okay.
As Sarah Silverman says, we're all just molecules, sweetie.
Yeah. I guess that's it. We did it. Mike Birbiglia, thank you for joining us on the Gotcha Podcast.
Thanks
we really appreciate it.
The first edition of the Gotcha Podcast.
I think it's going to be really big.
Yeah, I think
we're
so.
Just going to get people on and get them to say things like they resent their daughter and that they all the people that they don't like who perform at Madison Square Garden.
Yeah, like
and,
Is that one person's name?
I'm just trying to see if I get any spark of any of these names.
Dice. Yeah, Dice. Dice is the person I'm mad about.
That poster.
Oh, if I heard that career! We all grew up wanting to be Dice, and then we ended up being a bunch of nerds and talking on a podcast.
Hickory Dickory Doc.
Yep.
I'm so sorry.
Wait. I got a callback to Larry the Cable Guy as a trained actor, but I can't come up with a good callback for it.
Sir Lawrence, the cable fellow.
Sir Lawrence, the cable fellow. I wish I
Sir
could have had
Sir
that
Lawrence.
In an organic
you
way.
It, sir, if you got it now,
Sir Lawrence, the telly fellow,
the telly fellow,
the Tenno cable. I think it's cable.
Yeah. The BBC commentator.
Yes, fellow. The end.
Wow.
Let's just have this fade down.
Yeah.
As though the conversation's continuing, like on Charlie Rose, they keep talking.
Yeah. Oh, okay. What do you think they talk about? Well, I don't know about you, but I'm going to go downstairs and I'm going to drink there.
Oh, yeah.
I'm sorry, who's this?
You better keep that in.
Charlie Rose.
There goes your Charlie Rose potential.
I just feel like...
Oh, my God. Too much.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's like when Kevin Nealon, remember, there was some sportscaster character he would do on SNL.
Brent Musburger.
Yeah, that's right. He would just hold his
fingers
down.
Brent Musburger.
Like,
God. Oh, my God. I totally have to go.
Get out of here.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
Once upon a beat. Remember the stories and fables that captured your imagination when you were young? We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remixed and reimagined for the kids in your life today. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a music-filled weekly party hosted by me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, spinning tales in the New Kids and Family podcast, Once Upon a Beat, where hip-hop and fables meet. Hey, grown-ups, listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. Once Upon a Beat.